Welcome, everybody, and welcome to Talking Critics, sponsored by Toyota, the hatchback fit for a hunchback. I'm your host, Bob, or Fantastic Mackie, and this is the Talking Simpsons Patreon's chronological exploration of the critic. Who else is here with me today?
Henry Gilbert, and Oscar's got a brand new butt to kiss.
Who else?
I'm Diana Goodman, and when you least expect it, I'll strike back at you like a viper.
And as always, who else is here?
Michael Raparez, and you are going to kill me to take my rent-controlled apartment.
And today's episode is Every Doris Has Her Day.
M is for the many things I gave him. O is for the orphanage I dumped him in.
And today's episode aired on June 1st, 1994. We are no longer in the spring. They're burning all these episodes off in the summer. And as always, Henry will tell us which movies are out on this day in real life history.
Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book! Buy my book!
Oh boy, Bobby, Danny DeVito teaches Mark Wahlberg how to be a classy army officer in Renaissance Man. Woody Harrelson and Kiefer Sutherland are caught cowboys trying to solve a murder in New York City in the cowboy way.
I see.
And director Bruce Brown returns to the sport of surfing in Endless Summer 2.
Endless Summer 2, wow.
Yes.
It's not so endless.
wasn't Renaissance Man about when Danny DeVito was like teaching Shakespeare to...
He's teaching Shakespeare to recruits in the army. It is a very memorable poster of short little Danny DeVito in between two guys in army fatigues.
Is Mark Wahlberg in that movie?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
I thought so.
He's the one of the guys he talks. I believe one of the only joke I remember from it is he's trying to teach them classical literature, and a guy brings an Archie comic book to class, and he's like, Jughead's at the chocolatey shop. It's like, no, it's chocolate spelled old-timey. So, and that Woody Harrelson Kiefer Sutherland movie, I never heard of.
I never heard of that.
I remember the ads for that.
It's basically Crocodile Dundee, except with cowboys instead of an Australian,
right,
which is really just a different type of cowboy. Like, that
yeah,
is who he is. And yeah, I never watched the Endless Summer films, but they were all about how awesome surfing is. And
you've seen the poster at least.
Oh, I saw a poster everywhere.
Yep.
It's the neon orange skyline, mm-hmm, and a silhouette of a man with his surfboard.
Mm-hmm. And this episode is Every Doris Has Her Day. It's written by Steve Tompkins. I don't think we've had a Steve Tompkins episode on
yet.
He is one of the writers that would go from The Critic to The Simpsons. And Bill Oakley and Josh Weinstein like him a lot. I think he is the only like devout Christian writer
these
shows.
That's right. Yeah. And this episode would have aired on March 9th, but it had been replaced. And what was its replacement? The TV show Thunder Alley.
Oh.
A family sitcom where Ed Asner played a grandpa whose family moved in with him, and it had a very young Haley Joel Osment as cutest kid. Here's the commercial for it.
Grandpa?
What?
Where did your hair go?
I lost it.
Why didn't you look for it?
You know, Harry, before you moved in, I didn't have to answer these annoying questions.
Edward Asner stars in Thunder Alley, premiering Wednesday.
Yeah.
Grandpa?
What?
How come you have hair in your ears?
Whoa.
Zoink.
That is a really macho title for that show.
Thunder Alley.
Alley.
I thought, like, wait, was that show with Hulk Hogan? Or?
That's what I thought.
Was that Thunder in Paradise?
Yeah.
That's right.
And
now, I'm pretty sure I watched the entire run of Thunder Alley. Actually,
wow.
Let me see how long it ran. I think it only ran for a season, but I think I was just like, oh, The Critic's not on. I guess I'll watch this because I'm 12 and I'll watch anything.
It did much better at retaining Home Improvement's viewership. I will say that.
Yeah.
Every Doris Has Her – sorry. The previous episode to this one, it had 10 million viewers from the 18 that Home Improvement brought into it. And so then Thunder Alley kept more like in the 13 or 14 range. And Thunder Alley, yeah, I actually looked this up. It would technically be two seasons, but it would run – it basically was like one full season. But they – so they ordered like 10-ish episodes that ran from March until – August, and then in September, a second season started that had like another 13. I believe it technically has more episodes than The Critic, but only just.
So I did want to go over Steve Tompkins' writing credits. Mm-hmm. He co-created The PJs with Larry Wilmore and Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
He also was an executive producer of The Bernie Mac Show, and he also worked on A Living Color, Entourage, something called The Knights of Prosperity. But I have right here...
I want to want to say that was a Donald
Logue.
I think that was a Donald Logue joint.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. Yeah, and I have right here Josh Weinstein and Bill Oakley, who ran seasons of 7 and 8 of The Simpsons, says, with the exception of George Meyer, Tompkins has contributed more to season 7 and 8 than anyone else on The Simpsons staff.
Wow.
So even though he only is technically credited for a Milhouse Divided, he was a huge person in the writer's room in terms of like writing different bits and jokes and ideas and stuff like that. So
nice.
That is Steve Tompkins. He's no Steve Levitan, who is the most powerful Steve of all.
Yes. Two Steves on the writing staff, one woman. But at least they had a woman. And Nell Scovell. But this was a nice Doris-centric episode.
I love Doris.
She's just been a recurring smoking gag the rest of the show. And so –
we'll still get those.
Oh,
those aren't going
boy,
anywhere.
Do they?
Yes.
Like there's some really uncomfortable jokes about like you're going to die. It's like, yeah, she died in 96. Like she
yes.
is going to die.
And I feel like Al Jean and Mike Reese are moving their Patty and Selma jokes onto Doris. Like,
oh, absolutely.
She's inheriting all these smoking jokes.
And also, though, I wonder – this episode makes me wonder if they'd actually been renewed for a third season – how they would have dealt with Doris's death.
That's like, true.
What would have happened on the show once they ran out of audio they'd recorded of her? Would they just replace on Al Jean Simpsons, when actors have died, they don't replace the voice. They just retire the character.
I think there's a hint of what they would do, which is they would replace her with a very similar character, possibly also named Doris, just like they did with Bailiffs on Night Court.
That's true. And with Lunch Lady Dora,
yes.
who would eventually replace Doris Grouse.
That makes me angry. You can't replace Doris Grouse. I don't care.
Well, it's not. It's Dora.
Hey, they didn't say her name was Dora. They're just like, oh, Lunch Lady Doris is back and Tress McNeil is voicing her. And then they retconned her into being Dora.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a very angry post I wrote on No Homers Club when that happened. You can probably read it today. Like, you'd besmirch the memory of Doris Grouse. She was a beautiful woman.
They wouldn't have done that with Lionel Hutz, that's for sure.
No. So the episode begins. I didn't grab this clip. It is another
sucks.
In the vein of the tea cozy Howard Stern's End, where it's a Howard End parody, but Howard Stern just sticks his head in the window.
It's really
weird.
You
like my wife. She says what she never does.
The tea cozy was a better gag on a Merchant Ivory film, and then Howard Stern's End is just like cute wordplay that then has an okay – Maurice LaMarche is a great – impressionist, but his Howard Stern's only like, it's all right.
It's okay, right. But it should be pointed out that Howard Stern was probably never bigger than this period of time. Even though he just had a radio show and they would tape that and put it on E, he was calling himself the King of All Media, which would eventually end when he made a movie and stopped being the King of All Media.
Yeah, it's true. He was omnipresent, though. This was probably my first introduction to Howard Stern. He was certainly not on the radio in the South. Like, he was not syndicated in my area, or if he was, I wasn't aware of it.
I had a truck-driving uncle who would probably inappropriately give me tapes of Howard Stern, and I read Private Parts at this time. So I knew a lot about Howard Stern. I was like, this guy's cool. But it turns out maybe not. He's all right. And we do get another parody, which I did capture, and that is the JFK director's cut. And we'll hear that now.
Back and to the left. 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 Back and to the left.
Not done yet.
Back and to the left.
There you go. So I actually got the clip of this from the movie JFK. It's been a while since I've seen this, but I forgot that you see JFK's head explode like 900 times. It's kind of shocking. Like, wow.
Well, the film shocked the world with this. And the movie ends with basically a 20-minute long monologue by Kevin Costner explaining Oliver Stone's specific version of the conspiracy theory of JFK. But nobody saw him.
Yeah.
But nobody saw it. But I
think Seinfeld had the best JFK parody.
Slightly behind using Crying Game to make transphobic jokes, 90s sitcom writers loved Back into the Left.
Oh, yes.
They loved it.
So let's hear Back into the Left from the original movie.
Back and to the left. Back and to the left. Back and to the left.
So just three times.
But I mean,
you're doing Truman Capote there.
Like, he does a Southern accent. I mean, he's making the point that when JFK is shot, like the last time when his head fucking blows up, that he's falling backwards into the left, indicating someone on the grassy knoll shooting from in front into the right,
right,
not from a book depository.
Yeah.
JFK is a flawed movie. but it's really good.
Yeah, don't believe anything in it, but just enjoy the ride, I guess.
I mean, it is a filmed version of a million posts you can see on Facebook or of Twitter now. Just like, and actually, if you see this one Russian guy follow this other guy, and that would mean that the key to the conspiracy.
The real sniper was hiding on the moon landing set.
Doesn't get as crazy as most conspiracies get now. It holds together. It's plausible. I think he leaves some details out. Whatever. It's a good movie.
Yeah.
I like it.
But just the shock of seeing JFK's head explode.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
It's the same thing. Like, the Zapruder film was technically available, but you didn't want – nobody – they weren't going to show it on TV.
It's the most popular snuff film out there,
yes,
I think.
Yes, it is. Where else are you going to see the president's head explode?
And like, it's because it's slowed down for him to point out back and to the left. That's what makes it.
You can see a man's head explode. There's actually a very great episode of King of the Hill, a later episode, where Dale stops becoming a conspiracy theorist because he studies the JFK case and he realizes it makes perfect sense what the media told the media told the people. So he stops being a conspiracy theorist.
I love
briefly.
That one. And then Hank Hill has to tell him, like, well, no, sometimes the government does tell you the wrong thing. Like, he has to become the opposite of himself just to convince Dale not to believe everything he hears.
This is an ad for Talking King of the Hill, which we will do if you give us a lot of money.
So it was very strange that Sir Roger came to the interview in costume. He's like, I'm wearing the same costume I was in Howard Stern's End. And that it makes sense that they didn't want to draw him in a different outfit.
It's also – I like how his name is a dirty – reference. It's Sir Roger twice nightly.
That's true.
Someone getting Roger twice.
Well, and he would if he has three mistresses of varying ages
and genders.
I like that.
So he's giving Jay tickets to his new Broadway musical, Hunch. I believe it's Andrew Lloyd Webber.
And this is – I can explain it all here when we get to it. It is making fun of multiple specific Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals.
Excellent.
In 1994, Disney was absolutely on production of their Hunchback of Notre Dame. So I wonder if this was partially them making fun of that as well.
There was a thing in the commentary where they were saying, like, were you going to talk about this?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead, though, Michael.
Oh, yeah. But they were saying, like, yeah, we absolutely didn't know that they were doing that. And then it came out the next year, and it's like, didn't we get, like, some model sheets that showed the characters
to be
partially
based on that? No. You weren't allowed to talk about it. But the joke was, what is the least likely thing to be a musical? A story about a deaf and deformed man.
A deaf,
who shouldn't be able
mute,
to sing.
Deformed man who, in a story that ends with, like, murder and death and betrayal, which is not how the Disney version ends at all.
No, but I still like the Disney version. I like the songs in it a lot.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and it was good that they changed Esmeralda from a 16-year-old Muppet who is easily tricked into a older Demi Moore woman who also is not hung to death.
No.
Right after watching her mother get murdered as well.
That movie could really use a Phantom Edit, though.
Get rid of all the gargoyles.
Tony J's performance is one of the greatest things. His
fantastic
song about damnation is the greatest.
Hellfire,
Hellfire.
The Elder God from Legacy of Cain, Soul Reaver.
Yes. And I really like Ethel. I like his fake.
Yeah, we get the return of Jay's assistant, Ethel.
I did capture Ethel this time. He's trying to check with Ethel if he's free to see Hunch.
I'd like you to meet Ethel, but she just jumped out the window.
Just take the bloody tickets.
Oh, why don't you ever let me meet your friends?
Because the last time I did, you spilled coffee on Mr. Al Jolson.
Ethel, you're spilling coffee on me. I'm begging you, put down the percolator, honey lamb.
The second Al Jolson reference in The Critic. The second time John Lovitz does that.
It's the show really gets away with just having so many times like, well, what imitation would you like to do? Or, like, what impression would you want to do? Well, I could do Al Jolson. Like,
just random. Like, how many years ago was this incident? Al Jolson's been dead a long time.
Yes.
And then we get a Glenn or Glenda reference.
I loved her, hated him.
Glenn or Glenda, really ahead of its time. Not to be viewed in today's – don't view it as a viewer of today, I will say.
It's surprisingly progressive for its time.
Oh, the 50s? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Henry and I saw it with – it was being ripped by Frank Conniff and Trace Beaulieu from Mystery Science Theater.
The Mads are back. See you when they're in your town. But the – I love at the end of that movie that the solution is – well, no, you just have to be his mother, and then he won't want to be a woman anymore. And it's just like, well, no, can't they just be lesbian couple then? And like, no, and what a great deal for his wife that she has to become his mother.
But I thought part of the deal was, I mean, they say a million jillion times that he likes wearing comfortable women's clothing, but he is not a homosexual.
Yeah.
He just likes the soft feel of silk, but not a homosexual, which is hilarious because that's back when everyone wore girdles. Women's clothing was not comfortable.
They just have to look directly in the camera like, this is not a homosexual. It's not.
He's not a homosexual.
Secondly, we're not allowed to film homosexuals in Hollywood. Yeah,
obviously, but the homosexuals in this movie who wear women's clothing, they deserve to die in our corpses. But the other one, but again, that was the most progressive they could make it in the 50s. And yeah, it was way ahead of the curve on that.
Yeah. And Glenn or Glenda is kind of, it's a pretty obscure reference at the time. I mean, the movie Ed Wood has not been out yet.
Yeah, it's true.
I mean, it's just sort of an inside film gag for lovers of fine, terrible cinema.
And then we get a Never Be Clean joke, which
it's a little uncomfortable.
I do like Never Be Clean jokes in general. I think they're fun, but they can be really overused. And also, it's kind of an OCD, it's mocking OCD problem. So that's not her problem. It's that Jay is so disgusting that, like, just being on a date with him, like, did they have sex and she has to
shower for 3 days? She's got to be seriously waterlogged.
And my favorite ever Never Be Clean joke was on Wondershowzen, which if you ever see
me, right.
Never Be Clean, Never Be Clean, Never Be Clean, Mommy.
I love it. And Jay, we see him powering a jacuzzi with his farts.
Yeah.
At what the health?
Excuse me.
I like the Never Be Clean joke, especially because they sell it as like initially it's just like, oh, I'm just making an excuse for her. She's in the shower and I don't have a better line. And no, she really has been.
Just like, I have to wash my hair that night. To wash my body for 72 hours.
That is good. I do like that. And that's another Gene and Reese template with the fart jacuzzi is, wait, that X isn't Y.
Yes.
I'm just saying like, hey, that isn't even plugged in. Or a specific example I can think of, Homer's triple bypass. They say, so we put this dye in you to see your veins. Like, but doctor, I haven't injected the dye yet.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, good Lord.
But Jay does find a date in Doris.
Me go out with you? You're old enough to be my mother.
So you're fat enough to be my car. Besides, I just want to see the show.
All right, I'll take you. But if anyone asks, you're a doddering heiress and I'm running through your money.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell everyone you're a troll I found under the Tappan Zee Bridge.
That's great. So we forgot to do line of the show last time. I want to give line of the show to you're fat enough to be my car.
Yeah.
Can we give it that?
Yes.
Okay, your line of show.
I just made that up.
I just love the – it doesn't – I mean the logic is great. You're fat enough to be my car.
And but man, the joke of Doris coughing and then lighting up a cigarette, it's like –
yeah, I took that
funny,
out.
It is funny, but Al Jean and Reese really felt bad about that later. Making her cough. And then comes a joke that I really wasted too much time to figure out, but
I knew we'd have to explain this because
Oh Calcutta?
Yeah. Oh Calcutta, starring Sandra Bernhardt and Lyle Lovett.
I think I know the joke, but
so Oh Calcutta is a Broadway review, which means a series of sketches, and its big selling point in the 70s was you will see naked people. And so it was like it's naked people in sexy sketches, but really what it is just like it's the worst of 70s SNL, except you might see somebody's like balls, and that's kind of it.
The joke is these are people you don't want to see naked.
It's that too. But I mean, if you watch the O Calcutta, the 70s film is just entirely on YouTube. Nobody cares the filming of their review, and it just really sucks. If you want to see 70s bushes on Broadway performers.
Do I?
Yes.
Also, I guess the title is like a play on like the title of a French painting that's like the French phrase meaning what a cute ass you have.
Oh, okay.
And the image of it on the poster of a person taking off their robe, that is the opening dance number to it of everybody's in a robe and then slowly disrobing, and then they do a bunch of like moments chances posing, but nude, and so you're just supposed to. The the fun of like I'm seeing naked people just wears off so quickly. It's like, oh, this is lame. The art.
And, I just know that it's what Apu says after he gets laid in 22 short films. Oh, Calcutta.
Oh, Calcutta.
Yeah, or while he's getting laid out, rather. So I didn't capture a lot of the hunch songs because they're not that funny. But I did capture the last one. I do like the line, "Blame all your cares and woes on the one with scoliosis."
That's cute. This is pointed out in the commentary, Sir Roger is apparently the hunchback, but he is in extreme costume to be playing Quasimodo.
I sort of assume that he's playing like Frollo or someone we never see him.
All right.
We see the hunchback and we see Esmeralda and some kids that beat him with sticks and candy comes out.
Except they do confirm that that's supposed to be him. Yeah.
Oh, really?
They're
okay.
Like, why did we make the character like introduce him looking completely different than he does here?
It's funny. I was on YouTube capturing clips for this. I have the DVDs, but it's easier to capture from YouTube. And it was like a controversy in the comment section, like, where is Roger Twice Nightly? They lied to us.
And did you notice that the singers say Notre Dame?
Yeah, that annoyed me.
It's not the friend. I wonder if it was intentional or they just didn't bother to tell.
Were they making
singers
a rhyme, though, out of Dame instead of Dom?
They might have been.
Maybe they bent it to make a rhyme. I don't know.
And so these are the references that make it a joke on Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals of the 80s and 90s. So first off, in the opening scene, which takes place – it is not the opening of the book that Quasimodo is in the town center being having shit thrown at him. That is not where the book begins. But he is surrounded by roller skating chorus. And that is a reference to Starlight Express.
Oh, nice.
Where everybody
is
on roller skates.
Because it's about a train.
Yes. And smile in my spine. I like that line. That is a funny line. But also then the Andrew Lloyd Webber musicals were famous for their impressive props and spectacles, specifically the chandelier in Phantom of the Opera, which is the bell that falls on Jay's head is a reference to that. And also like the silence of my stone deaf world. That's a bit like in Cat's memory. Like there will be a spotlight for that same scene. So those were all the ones I could really tell that were a direct reference to Webber's musicals.
Well, here's the final hunch song.
So if you see a hunchback, why not take him out to lunch, Jack? To say hey, thanks a bunch, man. Thank you for being a hunch.
This performance was sponsored by Toyota, the hatchback fit for a hunchback.
There you have it.
that was a very 80-yard line. I wonder what it was before, but it's a funny line, hatchback. And though, again, on the seeing Gene and Reese steal from themselves, that end, the happy ending to a happy musical adaptation ending, that is Streetcar. Streetcar in The Simpsons did the same thing.
Well, the ending of the book, which I've read, is that years later they find that Quasimodo basically buried himself alive after Esmeralda is killed. Yeah. He just curled up with her corpse and died. So it's a feel-good story of the century.
That's why I was like, when Disney announced it, I was like, oh, geez, how bad is this happy ending going to be? It's pretty bad. Everyone loves him now, and Esmeralda's okay, and marries
up
a guy.
She ends up with Frollo instead of Frollo.
No, the captain of the guard.
Sorry, Edis. She ends up with him, and instead of him leaving her to die and living with his wife,
everybody's happy, and then there's a dance party.
And there was a sequel too, where he gets even happier.
Oh, God.
So that's funny that this. They're making a joke on a happy ending tacked on to something that it shouldn't be. And then Disney did exactly
that. In just 2 years.
Yep.
That's all it took. So there's a funny line where a kid says, you helped me believe in myself. And Jay goes, I'm not the hunch. I know.
Another Gene and Reese staple, although I love it. I'm not X. I know. And this is the second time in the series he is mistaken for a hunchback.
In
the first episode, she's like, oh, you hunchbacks are so sensitive.
She wants to rub his hunch for good luck.
Yes.
His hump, rather.
And then they go to Lane Richet, and that Lane Riche, I did it now.
We're doing it.
Damn it.
Lane Riche.
That Vlada's joke about her imminent death, again, not so funny when she's dead in 18 months.
I do like Vlada's subordinate, the guy with the bushy mustache who just touches his nose when Vlada gives him a command.
They do that two episodes in a row.
Yeah, I like that guy.
Though this feels like weird parallel thinking because those Vlada jokes are Luigi jokes. They're the jokes of the original jokes of Luigi, the Italian restaurant owner in The Simpsons, who would be introduced around at the end of season 5 on The Simpsons, airing at the same time as this.
Yes, the rude restaurateur is the common theme between these two.
Who would say, oh, I respect you so much, and then say, hey, look at this guy. But in Vlada's case, he is secretly saying it in his language.
He does it in a different language, but not in earshot, too.
That's true.
So Jay and Doris bond after the dinner at Lane Riche.
That play was terrible.
Well, that's the kind of thing I see all the time. Maybe now you see why I am so cranky.
You know, I'd really hate to be you.
Oh, it's not so tough being a critic.
No, I was starting a new topic.
Shut up.
Shut up.
Shut up. I love that.
Yeah.
Shut up.
And they're in Doris's rent control apartment from 1945.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite gags.
Put down the candlestick.
Yeah. She just rent controlled from 1945. Well, how much does it cost? $120. Put down the candlestick.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's great.
She knows immediately, like, just hearing that makes people want to kill her the second they hear it. And it introduced me to the idea of rent control as a kid. And now that I enjoy living in a rent controlled apartment now.
Me too.
So yeah. It's,
we can never leave. Though.
Never, just like Doris.
Yeah. So Doris is looking at a picture in a frame who it's not her husband, it's not her brother, but it's the great Gildersleeve and it came with the frame. When did she buy this frame?
It's all very confusing.
Yes,
so.
And I have to say, Henry sent me a clip, but the Great Gildersleeve is a Fibber McGee and Molly spinoff. Mm-hmm. He was a character on Fibber McGee and Molly, and it ran from 1941 to 1958 on the radio. Mm-hmm. So it ran for almost 20 years.
Yeah, and then would get a TV series as well. So Fibber McGee and Molly, he was on that show. The Great Gildersleeve was a recurring character who would kind of rip off Fibber McGee, like Fibber McGee would be trying to buy something and he'd be basically stealing from him and kind of an evil character. But as is the case on spinoffs, they lighten him a bit, make him a family man, but he's still kind of a wheeler and dealer is his character. And he was played originally by Harold Perry, and then he had a argument with his sponsor, Kraft and Parquet. So they replaced him on the TV show with a different actor, though Harold would originally take it. But they were both portly gentlemen with mustaches who actually don't look that much like the dude in the photo.
Not really, but you have a clip here.
Yes, this is some classic Great Gildersleeve comedy from the radio.
Right. Now, first you touch the starter. That starts the car. Unless, of course, you forget to turn on the ignition key.
Well, suppose you turn the key and step on the starter, but the battery is dead.
Who is that? Oh, yes, I see you now, my dear. Well, I'm glad you brought that up. That brings us down to dead batteries. Now, a dead battery...
Wait a minute.
Yes.
You aren't finished with the motor yet. In fact, you haven't started it.
Well, how can I with a dead battery?
That's great.
That's cute. Like, yes, that's kind of his catchphrase, too. If you want to listen to 800 hours of Great Gildersleeve, it's all on YouTube, copyright free. Nobody cares to keep it.
We own Gildersleeve now. Take that, Kraft.
The Critic will be right back, you TV-addicted couch monkeys.
We're building a special Wednesday with Home Improvement at 8, 7 Central, the premiere of The Critic and an all-new Home Improvement. First, Home Improvement at a special time. Then, from the people who brought you The Simpsons, The Critic.
I'll be reviewing Home Alone 5.
We left Kevin home alone, and he's only 23! Ah!
And an all-new Home Improvement.
Lucky that I brought an extra set of clothes.
What do we call these, one-size-fits-all?
Home Improvement, the premiere of The Critic and an all-new Home Improvement. Wednesday, starting at 8, 7 Central.
So I guess Doris tucks Jay in, and then he wakes up not remembering the night before.
He falls asleep. But he is fully clothed and then wakes up in like his undershirt and I'm assuming his underwear. So either Doris undressed him or he woke up and undressed and forgot about it.
That could be
but
it.
But it really – it's very confusing. When you see – without a commercial in between, it's a bit more confusing of how he ended up undressed.
But this is Jay waking up.
Another satisfied customer. But just who was the lucky guest star on last night's Love, Jay Sherman style?
Like a virgin. I just for the very first time. Like a virgin. When your heart beats next to mine.
Hachi machi.
And watching this again, I remember what happened in the show, but I was surprised they didn't make that an entire thing for the rest of the episode, Jay wondering if he slept with Doris.
Yeah.
They drop it pretty quickly.
They do. It's a cute – you get a cute joke of her singing like a virgin. Like that's really funny that this old woman would be singing that song and just the her little pause for hee.
Yes.
It's cute.
An extra dirty joke where Doris brings
God.
Back – Doris brings back Jay's – shaft boxers, A, your penis would come out of the fly where the A is.
Yes.
B, it says coming soon.
Shaft coming soon.
There you go, everybody.
It's shocking they got that on TV.
That's more of a Fox joke.
And
thank you very much.
This is not the Shaft remake, so these boxers are like 20 years old.
I guess he got them vintage or something, or maybe it was like his review.
I think he's just got super old gross underwear.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
once you get to a certain age, like yeah. I occasionally find things like I've had these since college.
Once the elastic wears out, then you can throw them out. Yeah, takes a good 15 years.
I don't keep underwear that long. 10 years tops.
So we do learn that Doris's name is Doris Grossman, very close to Doris Growl, the woman who plays her.
That is great. And it's another cute tour guide joke. I like those. And here you see blah, blah, blah. Those are funny. An easy way to present a joke. And then we get him looking at his schedule, and the binge purge is funny. In the season 2 premiere, they have a funnier variation on this, which is what I thought this joke was going to be.
Yeah.
In season 2 premiere, he's like Alice asks him out, and he's like, let me check my schedule, and it's manic depressive.
Yeah. I feel like he's more of a binge guy, not so much a purge guy.
Yeah, totally. And then we get the Daisy sing sequence, which – Bob, this was another thing we realized from deleted scenes on The Simpsons was Gene and Reese stealing from themselves.
That's right. And you'll hear it in our season 5 deleted scenes episode for Talking Simpsons. But in the original ending of Cape Fear, instead of it irising out on Jasper and female grandpa talking about a Steve and Edie concert, the final shot is grandpa dressed up like a Southern Belle and Jasper rowing her in a rowboat or a canoe and them both singing Bicycle Bill for Two.
Yes. Yeah.
And that was the original ending of Cape Fear. But they decided to reuse that in this episode of The Critic.
It is the same joke. And I feel like they cut that scene knowing they were going to use it on The Critic. Well, that's what I think.
There's another wrinkle about that. But if you've got a sound.
Oh, well, no.
First.
From the commentary, Gene points out that if he ever hears the song Daisy on a show, he knows they didn't have the money for not free song.
They had wanted a song from Harold and Maude.
That's right.
The Cat Stevens song.
The Cat Stevens song. If you want to sing out, sing out.
I love that
song. Not cleared. You can't sing it.
Well, and that Jay, they talked about that on Simpsons commentaries, actually, that Lovitz would sing that song at Gene and Reese, but about being gay. If you want to be gay, be gay.
And a very birds-like scene, except all the birds are vultures. Apparently a flock of vultures follows Doris around, just waiting for her to die.
It's a very specifically Hitchcock's The Bird scene, where they're all perched on
the jungle gym.
Yeah.
And, well, and Harold and Maude would be a great thing to reference for this because it is a similar situation of a sad man with an old woman and learning things from her, except in Harold and Maude, they do have sex.
Yes.
That's true.
But obviously, Cat Stevens too expensive, or maybe Yusuf Islam doesn't let people use his music too much. He doesn't license, though. There's a Cat Stevens song in Guardians of the Galaxy 2 used
that's
too great.
That's effect. Right.
It feels weird. He's Yusuf Islam now. Like, he's not Cat Stevens, but that's.
It has been for decades.
Yeah,
a very long time. Yeah.
He's the Peace Train guy. So, we up next on Coming Attractions, we see Holly Hunter in The Slide Whistle.
This is the story of a woman who can't speak, but finds her voice through her slide whistle. The time has come for us to make love. What do you think of me naked?
That's a parody of The Pianner. Am I correct?
Yeah. It is, yes, including the joke that Harvey Keitel did full frontal nudity in it.
Yeah. It was the 90s, and Keitel just had to get naked. That was the only full frontal nudity we got to see back then of men.
Of men, yeah.
Only Harvey Keitel.
Well, I think it's kind of bullshit now that guys wear fake dicks in movies for full frontal.
That's not fair.
And it's just like, what if it looks 80% the same as your flaccid dong? Then
hey, those movie sets are cold, right?
I guess, yeah.
That's true. This is a really current reference for them. I mean, this movie came out in 93, so it was still in theaters when they made this joke.
Mm. I believe on the commentary, Al Jean would say they would sit down and watch trailers and try to predict which movies would be big that they could, like, you know, have parodies of people would get.
Which is rough because, I mean, who would know this sort of arty-farty New Zealand movie about old-timey people and pianos and not talking, and Harvey Keitel's got Maori tattoos on his face. And
I think it had won a bunch of awards before it was released in America and, like, you know, the full circuit.
I think it won at Cannes or Berlin or something. Michael actually turned to me and said, wait, was Holly Hunter in The Piano? And that's why we're getting divorced.
It's happening on this show, everybody, next episode.
I only remembered Harvey Keitel and Anna Paquin being in it, but it's like, wait, Holly Hunter, really?
Yeah, I know. Someone you're expecting is so good at, like, buckets of dialogue and being super motor mouth, and she doesn't speak. And I mean, all the acting's with the eyes. She's not like making crazy, like super emoting because she's mute.
She never calls anyone a warthog from hell.
For the longest time, but for a time, Anna Paquin was the youngest Oscar nominee from that film, correct?
She's still not the youngest Oscar winner, though.
No.
Tatum O'Neal and Paper Moon.
Paper Moon, right.
But yeah, it's close, though, and she does great. And her acceptance speech is one of the cutest things ever. Aww. Because she's so overwhelmed. She's like hyperventilating.
I have seen that. Yeah, it's great.
Thank you.
And I love that the sound of the slide whistle reminds Doris of Charlie Callis.
Right.
She had added to one of her favorite Charlie Callis, which I almost had a Charlie Callis clip, but I was like, this is too annoying.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to know who he was like in the greater expanded universe of the Rat Pack, who would just show up and make a bunch of – he was sort of like the Michael Winslow of his day.
He was the Michael Winslow of the 60s, yes.
Except his noises were not as accurate.
Yeah, he just like –
Hong Kong.
The whenever somebody in The Simpsons grabs their collar, goes like – that is Charlie Callis.
Yeah, it's very exaggerated baggy pants comedy.
My favorite mocking of how annoying Charlie Callis is in Mr. Show.
That's right.
When they do the
Dr. Evil.
Don't kill me. Yeah. Doctor, well, not it is
pre Doctor Evil.
It is pre Doctor Evil, Doctor Evil, but is the telethon to get them to not kill the world, and that on it, Tom Kenny plays basically Charlie Callis, which is being very annoying.
Yes. Very, very annoying.
Very annoying. Yep.
So a lot of Act 2 is a montage, and a lot of it is visual. One of the scenes is Jay falling for the Punch and Judy routine.
That's great. I said, let me have it. It's so obvious. That
he doesn't even wait for them to say what.
Yes. They need to make that joke quickly. But Jay finds out that Doris could indeed
– But I think after the Punch and Judy show, then they have a nice reenactment of the Manhattan poster for the Woody Allen film.
Oh, right, yeah.
They're sitting by the 59th Street Bridge at lovely sunset, and then a big chunk of it falls out, and she says, make a wish.
That was very cute.
They would later reuse that idea for the opening of Critics Season 2, where it's Jay and Alice watching the bridge crumble.
That's true, man. Why do a joke once on The Critic?
Hey. It's a great joke.
Yeah.
And then Doris scares him, and he has a heart attack, act.
All right.
Which that is a reference to Billy Joel's Move It Out.
Yeah, right, okay.
I've been working too hard to give you a heart attack.
You wanna know by now. I kind of have PTSD from that song because I worked in fast food for an all too brief 3 weeks before I got a better job. And on the Taco Bell satellite radio, that song would be on like every hour.
Oh, my God.
It's like, why do you want a song about a heart attack playing a Taco Bell?
Excellent question. It did get a ton of radio play in the early 90s. So, like, I had heard it on the school bus a million times.
Huh. It's a fun Billy Joel song. Billy Joel, a New York institution, Long Island's own Billy Joel. Yeah.
That happened in the Bicycle Built for Two montage. There's a lot of scenes happening. That's the one thing. And then he is like a zap back to life and he sings yeah. rest of the song.
So here's a change I would do in the episode, just in a simple edit. They end the episode on him running into a carriage and then landing on his face. But this is more physically damaging to him than the other one. So I feel like the topper, that should have been ending the episode. The end of the episode should have been him finishing the song Daisy and not being dead and going, hello, baby. Ow. That should be the end of the episode, not him just hitting a carriage and landing on his face.
And that was a reference to the Big Bopper song.
Yeah. Yes. Chantilly Lace.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a great scene in the movie Walk Hard where it is it's John Ennis playing the Big Bopper. And he goes, hello, baby. And then he has an entire phone call on the stage. Walk Hard is a great movie, by the way.
It's so underrated.
Yeah.
It's the cheapest drug in the world.
You can't get addicted to it.
Stop fighting here in India.
Finally, we find out that Jay could be Doris's son.
Doris, do you ever think about what that stuff is doing to your lungs?
Yeah, it's holding them together. It's just too hard to quit. I gave it up once, though, when I was carrying my son.
You never told me you have a son. Where is he?
I wish I knew. I had to put him up for adoption.
Really? You know, I'm adopted.
It was 36 years ago.
I'm 36.
He'd make the funniest little noise when he'd spit up his milk.
Ahem?
Son!
Mother!
Now, wait a minute. We don't know that for sure yet, but I really hope it's you.
Jerry Sherman's a pig. Jerry Sherman's a pig.
He said that when I bought him.
That was Doris's parrot. Previously in the scene, the parrot said, no proven link, no proven link.
And is smoking.
Yes. What? That's not good for a parrot. I have a parrot, by the way. Yeah, Don't let your parrot smoke.
Doris Crow was an enthusiastic smoker.
Yeah, she was a chain smoker.
Yeah, and I've made jokes about Night Court, comparing her to Night Court people before on here. I didn't realize the show – I had forgotten the show had done it too.
Yeah, Selma Diamond was one of the bailiffs. She had a very Doris Grau voice and she died.
I think the first one. And then there was another older woman. I think her given name also was Selma. Same thing. She passed away. And that's when they bring in what's her name? Is it Marsha Warfield?
As Roz.
Yeah, they start. Like, maybe we shouldn't hire these really old ladies now. We'll bring in Roz.
Instead, Roz was like the Hulk on the show. I loved Roz.
Great, but went through a couple.
Maybe Selma from The Simpsons was named after Selma Diamond because she's a heavy smoker too with a raspy voice.
I would not be surprised.
She's not quite 80 though, but you know who's counting.
And. So then when they dig into if she is his mother, Doris really buries the lead that she slept with JFK in 1957 or 58. Like he was a senator then, wasn't he?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, he slept with a lot of women, so Doris could have been one of them. But the other potential dad was a short, fat, bald guy who always complained about movies.
Yes.
Like, I'm JFK's son.
Ich bin ein Kennedy.
Yes. That's great. But it turns out Jay's mom does not like this news.
Now, what has prompted this talk of your adoption?
Mom, Dad, this is Doris. I think she's my real mother. You're not upset, are you?
Oh, of course not.
Dinner is served.
Good. You can start by ripping the heart from my chest and serving it to me on a platter.
And we'll eat my heart tomorrow.
I love that.
We'll eat my heart tomorrow. That is great, though. Jay shouldn't be asking... It has been already established that they have filmed Jay as Mr. Bip when they adopted him.
It's
so
true.
They do have the footage of it. And Franklin talking about getting the chair was pretty cute, too.
That was nice. He's like, that's not me. He's like, all right.
Oh, and right before that, Jay tells us about his he makes a deliverance joke, which again implies Jay has been sexually assaulted.
What was that joke?
He's made only a couple errors in his life, including that
He needs to get over – if he can get over his issues with his being adopted, then he just has to deal with his prom night and his time in the canoeing in hillbilly country.
Right. I mean, like you said, Henry, if you want to make a rape joke, just reference the movie with a rape scene in it and you can get off with it. So a lot of deliverance jokes in not appropriate places, including like Tiny Toons things like that.
But I like that Eleanor, who before couldn't say she loved Jay without a cue card, when it is ownership of Jay and being his the mother, she's very clear of like, you're gonna rip out my heart and yes. steal him, eh?
And we find out that Margot's birth did actually happen. Eleanor gave birth to Margot, and she vowed to strike back at Franklin like a viper.
I love that.
And she smacks him with a candlestick.
He gets bashed in the head, which
the candlestick holder.
That would imply that's a good explanation for his mental state is that Eleanor bashes him in the head regularly with a candlestick.
Going down,
which very similar to down I go.
That's true. So we go to the where are they at the orphanage?
So
okay.
They go to the orphanage,
which is closing down. They're having a clearance sale.
Doris won't go in with them because it's no smoking, and then Jay gets three questions. And first off, Diana, as our Jewish person in the room,
yes.
is that song
Let's
he's singing?
Hear it first.
Okay.
Yep.
I can sing it for you.
By law, you're allowed three questions about your birth parents, as long as they don't enable you to identify them in any way.
Oh, all right. Three questions, huh? Well, there is something I've always wondered. Am I Jewish?
Now, what do you think?
I knew it. Idle, diddle, diddle, idle, diddle, diddle. My lachem, meek, and lachem, splokus.
I've sung that song because of the critic, Diana. Yep. What is it?
It's gibberish.
I thought so.
It's Yiddish-sounding gibberish.
Idle, malacha, leka, lekum, schmokus.
Okay, the idle, diddle, that's sort of like a la-la-la you hear in a bunch of songs. But, yeah, and he's just sort of a little bit of a fiddler on the roof kind of dance with it.
Yeah. It's sort of like Yiddish scatting, I guess.
Yeah.
Sure.
I've sung it, too.
And then I don't think Jay's second question should count because he tried to make a wish and the guy's like, I'm not a genie, I don't do wishes, then that shouldn't count as a question and he should get another one.
But he does get the home game, and this was hard to read on an HDTV. I don't think this was legible on an SDTV. It's like, who are my parents? The home game. There are two jokes here. One I had to look up, and one of them
I did too.
That was Steve Garvey.
Yes.
Yep.
He was a Dodgers player who just had a midlife crisis and fathered two illegitimate children in the late 80s, rather.
Right.
But he was also pretty popular in the late 80s. Like, I remember him showing up in like comic book ads and stuff. Mm-hmm.
He was a famous baseballer, and he's lucky as hell that Steve Harvey has better SEO. When you look up Steve Garvey kids, you get Steve Harvey kids say the darndest thing videos. You don't find any clips about Steve Garvey and his illegitimate children.
Right. Yeah. But there was a bunch of paternity suits. I think that was a joke. Yeah. That was a popular joke at the time about having more kids than Steve Garvey.
But that was 1989, and I had read that he had ambitions to like be a Republican senator or a Republican politician, and that dashed that, and
maybe your parents are a lumberjack or a rock star or a traveling salesman.
Though now every major sport has at least five like famous people who like, oh, they have like Evander Holyfield has like 11 children with 10 different women.
And we call those baby mamas now, and it's fine.
And more famously is Screamin' Jay Hawkins, musician Jay Hawkins. At least
he's got 13 wives.
At least 57 children he has.
What?
At least, and they some of his children like started a project of we can do DNA tests and just figure out who is a Screamin' Jay Hawkins child because we also want to make sure you don't marry each other or
that's true
without knowing
there are more descendants of his kids than Genghis Khan's I think now.
Oh, but you know,
Screamin' Jay Hawkins is famous for the song "I Put a Spell on You."
But do you know who had more illegitimate children than Screamin' Jay Hawkins?
No.
Cecil Jacobson, who impregnated 75 patients with his own sperm.
Yes.
He was a fertility doctor, and he's like, well, come to my clinic and I'll impregnate you. And it's like, oh, all the donors, I use code names for them just so we don't know who they are. And then he was investigated. He's like, this is all your sperm.
That explains the fertility doctor entry on the board.
Right. So yeah, that was what they were referencing. I believe there was like an SNL parody
from the SNL sketch.
Yeah, like just the 80 of us or whatever.
It was John Goodman was it, and it was a sitcom where he was forced to father all the children that he had created, and so it was an amazing visual of they just had like dozens of child actors surrounding him on stage. He's like, okay, whose birthday is it today? Yeah. Like five kids rose their hands.
Yes. Obviously, the title is a parody of the classic sitcom we all remember, Just the 10 of Us.
Oh,
no,
yes.
No, we don't remember that at all.
A spinoff of Facts of Life?
No, Growing Pains.
Oh, Growing Pains. I get those two confused.
That basketball coach sure is hilarious. Let's give him his own show.
What if he was a Catholic who can't stop fucking his wife?
And Heather Langenkamp from Nightmare on Elm Street is in that.
That's right.
That's one of the sexy girls.
She was the oldest daughter, I believe.
Yep.
I love Heather Langenkamp. She is unappreciated in her time. She is the heart and soul of Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which was so ahead of its time in horror films. It was a postmodern horror film before Scream. Oh, so good.
You know what else is unrecognized?
Mm-hmm.
The Dirty Dozen from 1967.
Yes, yeah, that's true. But oh, but
fucking
so,
Duke's gonna try to remake it. God damn it!
Before we get to that, I did not know what a Bartlett pear was, and so the joke for saying Mr. Bartlett, it's Sherman, like that him drawn as a pear is a cute drawing.
I like that drawing. So up next we have Doris. This is our clip at the beginning of the show. You'll hear it again. I want to tell you what this is all about. So here's Doris thinking about being a mother to Jay.
M is for the many things I gave him. O is for the orphanage I dumped him in.
Very cute. It's a parody of the 1915 song Mother by Theodore Morse, lyrics by Howard Johnson, and I will play...
Howard Johnson's right.
That's right. And I will play a clip from this. We'll get to O at least, because I find O is like the most insulting part of this mother spelling. So we'll hear it. It is very... It's like... imagine yourself playing Bioshock and hearing this on like on a damaged record player or something. That's what I think of when I hear this song.
M is for the million things she gave me. O means only that.
O is only that she's growing old.
Ouch.
It's like, let's immediately jump to the criticism. I want to see what T is. Hold on.
T is for the tears were shed to save me.
For her tears. So, great.
I always equate this song with the Married with Children parody of it.
Oh, right.
Then that spells daddy. A is for the apple of my eye.
Uh-huh.
And what's that spell? Daddy. That's right.
There's a lot of D's to make things out of in that.
Yes. And, but yes, you're right. Duke shows up to announce his Dirty Dozen thing. And so for plotting purposes, this comes so out of left field. If they had just had one line at the start of the show of like, well, Jay, I'm making my Dirty Dozen parody or my Dirty Dozen remake, and they could at least then have it not just have – Duke show up to be like, hey, I'm going to have a plot development right now. It's me, Duke.
It's a little sloppy. And one episode after, he has a reboot of Hee Haw, too.
Yeah.
So it is weird. So Duke Phillips is talking about all the people that are in the movie, and one of them is Michael Caine. He's like, you can't have a movie without Michael Caine. And he wasn't actually in that many movies around this time. He was like in three movies in 1992, two in 1994. I don't think
Not
he
bad.
Was getting around as much as maybe 1990. He was like in four movies. And I mean, none of these movies are good. Like A Shock to the System. Mr. Destiny.
Oh.
I will say The Muppet Christmas Carol is good.
Yeah,
I like that a lot. He plays
really
Ebenezer
good.
Scrooge. So
I do like that this Dirty Dozen idea basically predicted Expendables.
Yeah, you're right.
Except for like a couple people. And this was when all these actors were at the height of their careers too.
That's
so
true.
And I love the implication that he hired Saddam Hussein to play himself in it. And
he had to give everyone Tomahawk missiles. A whole mess of Tomahawk missiles.
Arnold was in Schwarzenegger. It's so great.
So here's Duke blackmailing Jay.
Look, I may not be handsome or charming, but I am honest. I just can't give a bad movie a good review.
Look, boy, you know when I let you stay in my Florida condo? Well, the shower nozzle was really a camera.
Oh, big deal. So I was naked. I was singing.
And eating a pie.
When the moon hits your eye like a big apple pie, that's amore.
That signals a serious eating disorder. His calendar was right. If you're eating an entire pie in the shower, you're clearly hiding it from someone.
It's going to be soggy and gross besides. What are you doing?
You can see the water splashing onto it.
Yeah, and he's drinking the shower water with his apple pie.
And it's like a whole pie picked out of the pan. It's like that's going to fall apart after your first bite. Mm. But it's funny. A pie is funnier. It's easier to draw.
It's easier to draw. That's right.
As we would learn from The Simpsons. And, oh, yeah, Schwarzenegger blows up a beer can, which is our first look at the duff of Critic is bloat beer.
You're right.
That is there. Every animated show has to have its own beer brand. On King of the Hill, it is Alamo. Mm-hmm. And on the new show, F is for Family, it's White House Beer.
Interesting. And is that like Billy Beer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And so
there was also Bicentennial Beer.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
But so here it's bloat beer, which is kind of an obvious – it's not as cute as Duff.
Duff is nice, but I like both of them. Yeah. We do find out that Doris has some dirt on Duke that apparently the delivery boy knows. He was called Puddles by his frat buddies.
Which I would guess mean he had a leaky bladder or
something like that.
The bed.
But, yeah, I mean, Doris is feeling a greater bond with Jay, but we find out that it's not true. She is not actually his mother.
This woman is your what?
Makeup lady.
Not anymore. You're fired.
Hey, I can always get my old job back. Riveting World War II bombers. I'm doomed.
All right. If you let her keep her job, I'll give your movie a good review.
How many stars?
2.
1 million.
2.5.
Deal. You also got to say, Oscar's got a new butt to kiss. The Dirty Dozen remake.
All right.
Thanks, Jay. I guess that says I'm not your mother.
Yeah, but it also says I have a virus only found in pigs, and I mustn't reproduce, and blah, blah, blah. Now, you know these tests. They're always wrong.
So, yeah.
It's bad news for Marty that he shouldn't reproduce.
Yeah, and for the kid in the previous episode.
Yes, that's true. It's always illegitimate children.
And just like that kid that Jay illegitimately fathered, it also goes, ahem, when it spits up.
That's true. So, if she's not his mother, then the flashback of a fat baby joke and that the baby has Jay's voice, it really doesn't make sense if it's not Jay.
Yeah, I always felt like this was a little bit cheap just to maintain continuity. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, this was a really sweet episode, and that is sort of a letdown.
I could see them as storytellers saying, let's not blow it in this one. In season 4, we can finally have the episode of Jay meets his real parents.
I was thinking about that. They would probably build more off of this. Maybe he finds his mother and then his father or whatever. I mean, there would be more to this. This is like an unsolved mystery in the Critic universe that we need to figure out.
I think that's definitely something they thought about when they made – when they set up in the very first episode he's adopted, they wanted to leave that as a mystery to be solved someday.
Yeah, they're like, remember what a major mystery it was in Bloom County when Opus was trying to find his mom? Let's make it like that. Our character's basically the same.
Boy, speaking of spoiled endings, that Bloom County, it had such a beautiful ending of him reconnecting with his mother. Mm-hmm. And then when they brought it back, they had to be like, well, now Opus needs to leave his mother, so she's actually very overbearing and horrible. Aww. It's like, boy, this throws the old ending in the garbage.
Yeah, yep. But I mean, I like this ending. I find it really sweet where they says, like, you know, your family is – you can make your own family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? And I totally like agree with that.
There's a cute scene. It ends, as we said, with Jay getting hurt with the won't be a stylish marriage. Watch out for that carriage.
I wondered with that bit that Dirty Dozen was super long. It's because the original Dirty Dozen for its time was a long movie. It was 150 minutes. Like, that's it's right. Not Ben-Hur, I suppose.
But it's awesome.
Yeah, no, it's great. And now, if a movie is 150 minutes and I'm going to see it now, I'm like, oh, a short superhero movie. It's not a 3-hour long Marvel movie.
Yeah, but I think he says what the Dirty Dozen remake's like 5 hours long.
Yikes.
And unwatchably bad.
Yeah. So that was Every Doris Has Her Day. I like this episode. I like Doris. I wish, as you said, Michael, the ending was kind of a letdown, and the thing with Duke coming in to end the episode, like, I have a problem. I have a conflict.
I'm going to create a conflict right now. Choose. She's fired or your morals are destroyed. Which is it?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I like this episode. I like Doris, and it's sad that we would only have her for so long. But at least she was all throughout the Critic. She made it through the Critic. God bless her.
Yeah. By the show getting canceled, it let her be throughout it. And yeah, this is one of the – I wish they had done more episodes like this that were showcase episodes for characters. We'll have one in a few for Duke's Oil. And though, did Jeremy, I guess the one where Jay dates Jeremy's sister is kind of a Jeremy showcase, but did he really get one?
There might be one. I have to look at the episode list again, but I'm sure he has like at least a B plot in one episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What did you guys think of the
I really like this one. This is one of the sweeter ones and a more complete story. And yeah, Doris is just a superstar every time she talks.
Yeah, awesome. Totally agree.
Cool. Michael, how about you? Yeah,
like I said earlier, it's one of the more sweet episodes in the critic canon.
Yes, you get
and,
that.
The ending was a little disappointing. I feel like most of the time when it tries to be sweet, it just sort of stumbles at the end and said like, wait, we're supposed to be a very cynical and horrible show.
Yes.
Everything we've built is about to crumble to pieces.
Let's have Jay get
injured.
Don't be
disappointed. Yeah.
It's like we have to undercut the ending. It's fine. And James L. Brooks is he knows how to write the sweetness in a way that is kind of it doesn't hold up if you think about it, but it's nice in the moment.
Yeah.
So yes.
But, I mean, I remember when this first aired, like seeing it and really liking it up to that point, and like, oh, that ending was sort of sad.
Hmm. Well, this has been Talking Critic, everybody. Thank you so much. I will not shill for our Patreon, because if you're listening to this, you give to us, and thank you so much. We're recording so far in advance. I'm hoping by the time you hear this, we will have hit our next goal, our Talking Tunes, Name to Be Determined show, where we just talk about random cartoons that you vote on. And I have so many ideas. People have been talking to me, will you do this? Will you do this? Will you do this? The answer is yes, but we need to fund it first. But thank you so much for listening. I've been your host, Bob Mack. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. My other podcast is Retronauts, a classic gaming podcast every Monday, occasionally a bonus episode on Friday. You can find that by going to Retronauts.com or looking for Retronauts in your podcast machine. It's there. Look for it. Thank you.
And I'm HENEREYG on Twitter, and I also want to thank everybody for their support to make Talking Critic happen, and thank our two guests, or well, not guests, the other co-hosts who come in on the goodness of their hearts. And I co-host a show now with Diana as well, 302010, right?
Yeah, 302010, where you look back on that particular week, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and 10 years ago, what's going on in 1987, 1997, 2007. Let's see, by the time this comes out, 1997 will have gotten more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a very big celebrity death that everyone's going to pay attention to for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Oh,
who's
Jesus.
It going to be? Maybe it's me.
Maybe.
No, it's me.
No, it's me, goddammit.
Who's dead in this room?
Well, let's just say people learned how to spell my name after this happened.
Ah, I see.
And you can also hear me, you can hit me up on Twitter at ListenANerd.
Like a candle in the wind.
That's
and
me.
Michael.
You can catch me on Twitter at Wikiparaz, WikiParaz, not easy, A-Z. And you can also listen to Vigigame Apocalypse, which, contrary to what I said on the previous episode, is a wonderful show that you should all listen to. Please stop leaving in droves, which I assume you're doing.
Hey, who got to you?
Everybody.
Why are you changing your mind?
The Russians.
Damn it.
you can check that out at vigigameapocalypse.com.
Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with Marathon Mensch. See you then.
Excuse me, sir. The show's over.
But I have nowhere to go.